Good morning. Finding Dory, now playing in theaters, may make many kids want a Dory of their own. The Center for Biological Diversity's Nicholas Whipp says that's anything but a benign request, and we'll hear why later this hour. Is hard work the key component to success? That's one of the questions Hawaii Business Magazine asked in the latest Business Outlook and Sentiment Survey. Editor Steve Petranek has the details. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Is traditional publishing about to be replaced in the digital age? We'll talk with a Waimanalo-based publisher who believes in books as found art objects. And Joe Moore's radio drama Maligned Master is about restoring a reputation, one that was defined by a work of fiction. He's here to ask us to listen again to the music of Antonio Salieri.
For an Aloha Friday, June 17th, that's The Conversation. Coming up next, the news. Revving your engine for a weekend. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. As the conventional wisdom goes, if you work hard, you're going to do well, right? That's
right.
What I always heard.
Well, and a lot of us heard that one, too. And it seems to be truth, at least according to a survey that we're going to talk about right now. Now, whether you're an owner, a manager, or a staffer, you no doubt spend a lot of time at work. Americans, we're told, work longer hours, anywhere from 47 to 59 hours a week, according to several studies. And in some cases, those hours are a mark of privilege and power. But is all that hard work making for better business and translating into getting ahead? Hawaii Business Magazine released its Business Outlook and Sentiment Survey this month. Editor Steve Petranek is here with the findings. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you know, let's start with something happy. Looking at happiness at work and getting ahead.
So I love my job. I'm very lucky to have a great job, but I wanted to know if other people were happy at work. So we asked the survey twice. We asked the question twice, once to business leaders in the boss survey and once to ordinary people in Hawaii. And in both surveys, the results were very promising. 94% of business leaders said, yes, I am happy at work. I am personally happy at work. We asked the same question to ordinary people in a sample the same size, 400 people, and 83% said, yes, I am personally happy at work. That's extraordinary.
So how does that compare with what we see nationally?
Well, I didn't see the same wording nationally, but there was a survey, and it asked a similar question. Are you satisfied or dissatisfied at work? And what was extraordinary, it was that only 48% of people nationally said they were satisfied at work. That's a huge gap between a similar question in Hawaii. Are you happy at work?
Which seems to say that life in Hawaii is a little bit better than elsewhere, perhaps, at least if you're working. But how does that mean that you translate that happiness in your job and in many cases, from what we're told by a lot of very recent surveys, working longer hours, translating into getting ahead?
Well, we asked a similar question, again, to business leaders and ordinary people, and that was the way we asked it. We asked, do you agree or disagree that most people can get ahead today if they're willing to work hard? Are you willing to work hard? You will get ahead. And of local people, 61% said yes. If you're willing to work hard, you can get ahead. And that was exactly the same percentage among our business leaders in Hawaii. Now, you asked that question nationally. We looked for a survey. It was actually asked by Oxfam America. And it was asked of 800 U.S. workers making $14 or less an hour. So the working class. And they had almost exactly the same percentage. 62% said, yes, you can get ahead if you're willing to work hard in America. So as you said, there's some surveys that are showing that, in fact, compared to when I was young, it's harder to get ahead in America. The working class people, the people in the bottom quintile of income, their children tend to not get into the upper class. Only 10% of them do. If it was an absolutely fair system, 20% of them will get in. One-fifth of the bottom one-fifth should get into the top one-fifth. That only happens to at half of what it should be. And in fact, surveys are showing that upward mobility is easier in Canada, in Britain, in Denmark, in all kinds of other countries. In fact, America, the land of opportunity, is less the land of opportunity, at least statistically speaking, than it used to be.
That's a tough one for a lot of Americans to swallow. But that's coming along with a lot of other information that says that America has fundamentally changed.
Uh-huh. It has. But it's that belief in hard work and getting ahead is still a very strong part of our culture. Now, of course, 61% said, yes, you can get ahead. A huge percentage said, no, you can't. You need connections. You need money. You need some special advantage in order to get ahead. And that was true both in Hawaii and nationally.
So the idea that you can get ahead by working hard is shown enough times to make people believe it, at least majority beliefs according to this survey. But then you've got some realists who say, not so much.
And it's still possible. It's just harder than it used to be. So yes, America is still the land of opportunity. It's just a lot tougher than it used to be.
Okay, so let's look at Hawaii per se. When you looked at some of the performance of businesses, what seemed to be really extraordinary was how long businesses have been performing well. We hear, you know, some people say, well, you know, things are still a little dicey, but we're also told by UHERO continually, hey, we are in good times and this is as good as it's going to get.
I love that phrase, as good as it's going to get, because we've done the BOSS survey back to 1999. We have stats. We do it twice a year. And previously, we did it even more often. This is the longest sustained good times economically that Hawaii has ever had in recent memory. And it stretches back on the performance index, which is part of the BOSS survey. It goes back to April 2012. We have month after month after month of really good results. And, if you believe that things run in cycles, and economic history teaches us that, this isn't going to last forever.
So what about the optimism index?
When we ask about how their companies are performing, the 400 business leaders also tell us, what do you think about the future? And it's still at a very high rate. It's not – the peak was in 2014, early 2015, but business leaders are still very optimistic. And what that means, what it translates into, they're going to invest in more locations. They're going to hire new workers. They're going to maybe increase production. So that's all good for the local economy. What's going to hurt us? Well, 46% of them said if something hurts the local economy, it's going to be the cost of doing business. That's the big hurdle that they face.
The cost of doing business these days often means cybercrime prevention.
Yes.
And many more businesses looking at that and understanding how much more they have to invest into that.
We asked them, have you taken extra cybersecurity measures over the last 2 years? 60% said yes. Now, the good news is that we also asked the question, have you been the victim of fraud or theft in the past 2 years? Only 21% of business leaders in Hawaii said yes. So that's a very small, one-fifth of business leaders said we've been victims of crime. That's a small amount. Let's keep it that way.
All right. We'll end on that piece of reasonably good news. Thank you, Steve, for coming in. We'll talk to you next month.
Love it. Thank you.
Steve Prochanek is the editor of Hawaii Business Magazine, the longest-running regional business magazine in America, published monthly. And the BOSS survey that we just touched on is out this month.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:12, and coming up in the show, a Waimanalo-based publisher creates his own pop-up bookshelf. But first, your quiz.
We just talked about the latest business outlook and sentiment survey from Hawaii Business Magazine. Hawaii has a rich history of journalism, especially considering the written word was a new concept to 19th century Hawaiians. Missionaries who started Hawaii's first Western schools introduced newspapers as a way to teach and test their pupils. These early newspapers were used to increase literacy, teach subjects, including zoology, and create a written record of goings-on in the kingdom. The missionaries also used these publications as a means to impart their religious and moral views on Hawaiians. These early journals were not only used to teach English, many were published in Hawaiian. In fact, for 20 years, all newspapers in Hawaii were written in the Hawaiian language. For today's backyard quiz, we'd like to know what was the name of that first newspaper published in Hawaii. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the Hawaii Public Radio T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Malia Maddock McManus from the Honolulu Zoo Society. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It takes courage to embark on a book publishing venture at a time when print is widely thought to be dying. But book lovers are a determined lot, raised on the tactile sensations that a good book can give you, and on the pleasures of building your own library. De Meyer Publishing is an independent publisher of literature and art photography based in Waimanalo that celebrates what its founder and managing editor, Omer Corsat, calls the physically manifested objet d'art. Omer is with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
The whole physical sensation of reading a book, if you grew up with it, is very much part of the experience.
Yes, it's not comparable to anything else, you know, real versus virtual.
Mm-hmm.
And also the browsing experience, which has disappeared, you know, with the bookstores, to be able to walk into a bookstore, look at anything, you know, not with the intent that you walked in, but to be able to see other things and look at them.
You know, I think many of us have sort of grown up on that ritual. It's almost as if you find a sense of calm walking along a bookshelf, right? Your heart rate slows as you get immersed in the whole thing of looking for titles, looking for authors you love, right?
Yeah.
So you grew up on that. What was your environment growing up was in the book world?
Oh, pretty much print. And, you know, my father was in publishing, too. He published his own newspaper, daily newspaper. This is back in Turkey, in Izmir, in the 50s and 60s. So I grew up with telex machines, you know, typesetting machines, journalists, you know, photography and such. So I think there's an influence there, too, you know.
Or would have to be.
There has to be. I mean, we're all influenced with what we grow up with one way or another.
Sure.
So this is not a passion in that sense, but it's something that I do organically. It just comes about.
You know, a passion would be something that was sort of added on to your personality as opposed to something that flowed from it, right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. What are the things that you emphasize in the books that you publish by yourself and others?
Well, this started with my own photography. Mm-hmm. That was the very start in 2011. And then it turned into other things, just, you know, people that I meet, to authors, poets primarily. So I'm concentrating on fiction, poetry, and art, photography, primarily. And it's just to be able to influence someone. I don't want to say change a life, but that's what it is. Just to be able to share, be part of the culture, contribute to the culture.
To do what books do.
Yeah.
What did it take to sort of get operational, right? You need to get a hold of a printing press. You need to create a facility or get access to a facility to make these things for you.
Well, the first book was printed locally. Mm-hmm. And then the others are printed on demand. You know, we talk about technology, good or bad, but it's both, really.
Yeah.
Because print on demand, you can print one copy or 100 copies. It's great that you don't need to print 5 or 10,000 copies. And I always joke, you know, in Hawaii, we don't have a basement or an attic to store them in, really, in the typical sense. So print on demand. and it becomes available, soft cover or hard cover. There are, you know, various outfits doing it. So that's what it takes. And the technology has helped the typographical book design aspects of it, obviously. So using technology for an older technology kind of thing.
So you you need to be less of a specialist in things like layout and design. You can actually create a book.
Well, I get support.
Yeah.
I get support from friends, I will say, you know, from cover design to typographical advice to layout and the content, from editing too. I'm sort of like the managing editor. But I get a lot of help, support. So
yeah.
It's a company in that sense, in a virtual sense.
Makes sense. I mean, but you can get access to printing on demand through going online. There are kinds of various online.
Yeah, various outfits. And it becomes available online for sale. So you don't have to do the inventory and the stocking. You know, you don't have to physically have them. Although I always keep, you know, several hundred copies around.
How do you reach the public then?
Well, that's the big marketing aspects of books. You know, it used to be the standard model. You know, you carry the book, you know, published in a catalog, and then the bookstores ordered it.
Right.
Maybe 2 copies, 200 copies, depending on the sales. That has changed. Online sales, it's in a sense, has created a lot of, with self-publishing, has created a lot of noise from, you know, I can mention Amazon, I suppose. 10,000 volumes become available per month, including, you know, cookbooks, children's books, everything.
You mean new books?
New books become available 10,000. So how do you stand out among the 10,000?
Yeah.
That is the issue. So we came up with this new Hound and Quail, you know, the shop in Chinatown. My latest motto is bookstores are dead, long live the bookshelf, which is in a joking way, but there's a lot of truth to it. You know, bookstores, they're not dead, obviously, and they're coming back. Independent bookstores are coming back. But I think it's becoming more focused. I call it publishing house focused. Instead of carrying everything, anything, I think the bookshelves in stores or bookstores will focus on specific things like photography, literature, or there'll be a bookshelf of cookbooks at an appropriate boutique. So that's what we're trying to do. So with Hound and Quail, we have a bookshelf, Demare Bookshelf. It'll carry all Demare publications.
And that's a store that sells a variety of different things, not just books, right?
Yeah, Hound and Quail is vintage collectibles and curiosities. It's another thing. You can look at these things online. Yeah, it's a picture, whatever. I remember that. I've never seen that.
Yeah.
But when you walk into the store and feel it in your hands, look at it, totally different experience.
Well, we certainly don't want books to be one day categorized as vintage curiosities, do we?
No, and it'll never be. I don't think so.
Well, that's refreshing. But the whole idea of a pop-up shelf in a store dedicated to other things, that sort of breaks the model of the store that sells only books. But that has been a beleaguered enterprise for some time now.
Yeah, well, I call it a trend. I think that's where it's going to shape. I mean, it's always been around. Every store, boutique, gift shop carried some books.
Sure.
But I think it'll be more specialized.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world, Omer.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's good to talk to you this morning.
Same here.
Omer Crissat is the founder and managing editor of Demare Publishing, an independent publisher of literature and art photography based in Waimanalo. Its books will be featured in a dedicated pop-up bookshelf at the Hound and Quail in downtown Honolulu, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Oi, tudo bem? This is Sandy Tsukiyama, host of Brazilian Experience. To celebrate Father's Day this week, I'll be bringing you 2 hours of musical fathers and their children, like the three generations of Jobims and the Caymmis. That's Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6 on Brazilian Experience.
Nielsen research tells us that on the street where you live, it's likely that 1 in 8 of your neighbors listens to Hawaii Public Radio each week. Some of them have gone beyond merely listening and with their financial support have made our service available for the rest of the community. Please join us in thanking these good neighbors, Lai Merchant of Honolulu, Paul Connery of Kailua, and Celia Haynes of Makawao. You too can do the neighborly thing and become an HPR member donor by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours or go online and visit us at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for today's programming comes from Kahilu Theater, presenting the youth troupe production of the musical Grease, on stage tonight through Sunday. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
With a $1.5 billion shortfall, the cost of rail has Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell now saying the line should stop at Middle Street, 5 miles short of the original route. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check on the turnaround. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, this was not his opinion not that long ago.
You know, the mayor has always been committed to building the full 20 miles to go to Ala Moana, you know, from East Kapolei, and frankly to carry it on further at some point to UH Manoa. But now, recognizing this shortfall, the mayor is saying, and by the way, Chair Ernie Martin of the council agrees, that Middle Street is the best alternative for now. The mayor is saying that this doesn't have to end the project. It could conceivably later extend to Ala Moana. The problem is having the money to take care of this. The project is now 60% over budget than what was originally forecast. Now, even though rail projects tend to go over budget on the mainland, quite a few of them, not quite to this degree, 60%. The current price tag, we have to breathe in carefully here, $8.3 billion. And of course, it's been pushed back to 2024 for its construction completion.
So at this point, given the fact that the mayor and the council chair seem to agree on this, what's going on with the HART board? Are they buying it?
Well, Colleen Hanabusa, the chair, said that HART could take up as early as next week this possibility of having the Middle Street route. Dan Grabauskas, who's the head of HART, said they will begin evaluating the cost to stop at Middle Street. Remember, there's a deadline looming, the FTA, which is given $1.5 billion in federal funds, wants a recovery plan in place by August 7th. So definitely the clock is working against folks. I would imagine they'll be moving very quickly. One of the big questions is, how much will Middle Street cost? Will it really be all that less expensive? Remember, you're going to have to integrate a bus system to have people, you know, get off the train and get on buses. You're going to have to move an electrical substation. And then remember this. The rail will not be going anytime soon to Chinatown, to downtown, to Kaka'ako, and Ala Moana. So the ridership is going to drop considerably. And, of course, ridership means fares. So big questions as to whether Middle Street will be all that attractive a financial alternative.
And part of this conversation also goes back to the fact that we didn't really see a whole lot in terms of revenue to maintain the rail system in the first place. So this
right.
throws a There's, whole other set of questions that you just aptly named.
Sure. And let me just give you some other reactions. Kim Pine, the council member whose district is out there in West Oahu, she calls this decision just stupid. This is not a good idea. She says she won't ride the rail. Meanwhile, politics is very much at play. Peter Carlisle, the former mayor, wants his job back. He said it's just inconceivable. It's unwise to stop at Middle Street. He's saying Caldwell just wants to get reelected. That's why he's flip-flopped. That's what Charles DeJoux is saying. He's open to alternatives and maybe Middle Street, but let's not use any more taxpayer money to pay for this. So this has very much become the issue, already was, but elevated to a new level with the development of Middle Street.
Yeah, absolutely, and wondering if there's going to be a public-private partnership possibly in the future for all of this, too. We've talked about that in past. Oh, well, we'll have to wait and see.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
You're welcome, Chad. See you next week. Chad Blair joins us daily with a reality check from Civil Beat.
Good morning. It is 8:29, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. If you want to be in touch, there are plenty of options. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217. We're also on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, Joe Moore creates a radio play to restore the reputation of a major composer.
On the next Fresh Air, Mike Matheny's had a remarkable career as a durable big league catcher, manager of the St. Louis Cardinals, and little league coach.
I'm an encourager. I believe it's a gift that I have, and I know that not just baseball players. I think you know somebody needs encouragement if they're breathing.
Matheny's won more than 400 games as a manager. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
This Week in This American Life. Lindy West is fat. I know it's weird to hear me say that, but that's the word she uses. She's tired of the euphemisms. Though for years, that was not something she ever said to anybody.
I always felt like if I didn't mention it, that maybe people wouldn't notice. Or it could just be this sort of polite secret, like open secret that we didn't address because it felt so shameful.
This Week.
Saturday at 1 p.m. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
On this Father's Day weekend, some of you may hit the movies for family-friendly fare, including the much-anticipated Finding Dory, a forgetful blue tang who often gets lost. That could mean a lot of kids asking for a Dory they can always find in their house. According to Nicholas Whips, an attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity's Oceans Program, those seemingly benign requests have serious consequences for the fish and the reefs because of the practice of cyanide fishing. Nicholas Whips is on the line now from his office in Oakland, California. Good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
In the piece that you have, the report that you've produced with for the fishes, you say that about 6 million tropical marine fish are imported into the United States each year and have been exposed to cyanide poisoning. How did you get that figure?
So we got that figure partially through a Freedom of Information Act request that we did, where we got the last 10 years of import information. And then we combined that import information of all of the total number of live reef fish being brought into the United States for the aquarium trade. We combined that information with a new study for the fishes. And that study was done through the Hereticus Laboratory in San Diego. That determined that 50% of all of the fishes that they tested positive for cyanide poisoning.
Those are a lot of fishes. What happens when, or what rather is the process of fishing with cyanide?
Cyanide fishing is done by squirting dissolved cyanide directly onto the reef to stun the fish that the fishermen would like to capture. And in the process, it kills approximately 50% of all the fish and invertebrates on the reef on contact. And it's a cloud that travels down the reef, and it kills corals in its path as well.
So you're not just talking about the fish that are stunned that wind up in tropical fish boutiques, but that you're also talking about very serious damage to the reef.
That's correct. And because so many fish die before they make it into the United States, we're talking about at least 14 million other fish that are killed along the way. It creates a pretty large number that can be hidden just by looking at the number of fish that make it into the United States.
Right. Your point being that this is not just about a blue tang that a kid might want and what that impact is, but the fact that that may be driving some greater damage and degradation to the reefs in ways that would be perfectly preventable.
That is correct. And so the Center for Biological Diversity for the Fishes and the Humane Society actually submitted a petition last March to request that the United States government enact some simple steps to make sure that these fish aren't brought into the U.S. market.
And where is that petition now?
That petition is sitting before three agencies, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, and the Fish and Wildlife Service. They are currently reviewing it.
Isn't cyanide fishing illegal, though, in many countries?
Cyanide fishing is illegal in the main exporting countries, such as the top three, the Philippines, which supplies about 45% of all those millions of fish, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka. And the reason that it's illegal here is because it's illegal there. We have a law that says you can't bring fish that have been captured illegally from another country into the United States.
So is this going back to the issue that these laws aren't enforced?
These laws are not enforced on either side of the ocean, unfortunately.
So many people would be asking, so what good are they and what needs to happen so that they are enforced?
So that's the crux of our petition. We ask that the agencies on the United States side enact a simple test that's fast and easy to apply on a broad scale to test imports of fish that are brought into the United States for the aquarium trade. These are reef fish, not freshwater fish. You test these fish for cyanide exposure, and any imports that have been tested positive for exposure, these U.S. authorities have the right to deny that shipment from entering into the United States. So that's an effect that can cause a ripple through the entire supply chain and send a very strong message that cyanide fishing is no longer going to be profitable.
For a lot of parents who are going to have kids go with them to see Finding Dory and say, well, it's possible for us to get one, your message to them would please let's not do this. But really, how are you asking parents to talk about this with their kids? Because that's a lot for a kid to understand that fish aren't necessarily coming from the store. I mean, there are a lot of kids who don't understand that, you know, the meat doesn't come from the grocery store either.
That's correct. And the royal blue tang, which is the fish species that's the star of Finding Dory, is 100% sourced from the wild. So Finding Dory, just like Finding Nemo, creates this good conduit that parents can use to talk about these fish, get their children curious about where they come from, and if the parents are able to, then use that as a tool to educate their children. That would be an excellent way to get their attention and get them thinking about these bigger issues.
So you'd like them to go find Dory online and not at their local aquarium store?
That's correct. You can find Dory in movie theaters and online, and definitely share your love of these fish, but use that love to protect the reef.
Certainly this is not welcome news for a lot of aquarium and aquarium trade folks who have been looking forward to having maybe a little bit of a bounce in their bottom line because of this film and because of interest in royal blue tangs. There is a real, as you know, long-standing chafing between those who are in the industry and those who have been talking about where these fish are farmed. Is there any way of bridging that gap?
Yeah, we have actually, the Center for Biological Diversity, the way that we talk about this, and especially for the fishes, have been trying to find positive middle ground. For the Fishes has produced a really good app that you can use. It's called Tank Watch. And this app can give you information that explains whether a fish is likely to have been collected from the wild, like the royal blue tang, or whether it's a species that is often captive bred. And captive breeding obviously doesn't have nearly the extent of environmental impact that wild sourcing can have. And so a lot of our concerns come from the fishing practices, which can be changed with a nudge. And so that's why we're asking the U.S. government to provide that nudge. And so that can create a much cleaner and more sustainable collection method as well as a sourcing method, either captive breeding or better ways to fish.
Nicholas Whips, what you're talking about is something that's very driven toward consumers, but in terms of the aquarium industry itself, have there been any bridges that have been able to be made, or a couple of, you know, pavers down a road to be able to stop some of the antipathy between both those who are trying to see that the fish are handled responsibly and well, and those who are really trying to make sure that they don't lose their businesses?
Absolutely. And I think what it comes down to is we all love these fish. We all love the reef. And so that love is a good way to bridge that gap. Practical ways that wholesalers and resellers can make sure that they are able to provide a sustainable fishing system and to make sure that that's in place is it could just be around the corner. It's about stopping these destructive fishing practices, one, and then shifting to more sustainable practices such as captive breeding. So that allows a good common ground, a good middle ground to compromise with.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there for the moment. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
Nicholas Whips is an attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity's Oceans Program. He's worked on coral reefs and reef species protection in Hawaii, Florida, the Great Barrier Reef, and the Coral Triangle. And his most recent work focuses on the impacts from the 6 million cyanide-caught fish imported into the U.S. each year. A link to the report is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Nadine Tensala from Hawaii Independent Physician Association. You're tuned to HPR 2 Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Today in the backyard, we wanted to know the name of the first newspaper published in Hawaii. The journal in question first went into circulation in 1834 on Maui. It was actually a student newspaper, the product of the Lahaina Lua Cemetery, which is now high school. Not only was this the first newspaper in Hawaii, but Lahaina Lua was actually the first newspaper building west of the Rocky Mountains. As was the case with all the papers of the time in Hawaii, it was published in the Hawaiian language. And it was not until 1856 that an English-language newspaper went into circulation. Our mystery newspaper set the stage for many other publications to follow suit, including the Kahoku Okapaki Pika, Star of the Pacific, whose editors included one David Kalakaua. But it all started with the trailblazing Kalama Hawaii, or the Hawaiian Luminary in English. It is 8:47, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's all too easy for an inaccurate perception to take hold, even one that proceeds from a work of fiction. When playwright Peter Schaffer adapted the life of Mozart to the play that became a movie, Amadeus, he needed a conflict to move the story along, and he found it in an imagined rivalry between Mozart and one of his contemporaries, Antonio Salieri, described in Schaffer's telling as a jealous mediocrity. Joe Moore is a veteran communicator who knows a little about how perceptions are formed, for good or ill, and he's created a radio play that brings Salieri back from the grave to give his own account of himself. The play is called Maligned Master, The Glory of Salieri, and Joe is with us this morning. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Chris.
I like the framing device that you've created for this, because it's set in the present day, right?
Yes, it's actually set at the Blaisdell Concert Hall, where an all Salieri concert is going to take place. Mm-hmm. And I play the HPR host that is going to be the host for the evening, introduce the different overtures of Salieri that will be played by the Slovak Radio Symphony Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And just to give it a quick setup, just before the concert is to begin, the ghost of Salieri drops in to listen to his music because it is so seldom performed today, and here is this entire concert being devoted to his overtures.
The word has reached him wherever he is, right?
Upon high, he's looking down and, in Hawaii, they're going to play my music. I have to go hear it. And I convince him to be the host for the program and talk about his music and his life, particularly with Mozart.
And he is, in most people's minds, embodied by F. Murray Abraham,
who played Salieri in the movie Amadeus.
Yeah.
Yes. Murray and I are friends of about 10 years. When I first tried to recruit him for a play out here I had written called Prophecy and Honor, which was really mm-hmm. the story of the Billy Mitchell court-martial.
Right, I remember. Yeah.
He had accepted the role as Mitchell's civilian defense attorney, but then had to drop out because he got a film, which is not unusual for a working actor.
Yeah.
And so I wound up really getting lucky when he did drop out and got Richard Dreyfuss to step into that part.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that's how I first came to meet Murray Abraham. And over the years, we've kept in touch primarily through email. And then when it was about a year early last year, I had read a novel by Ian Kyer, a Canadian lawyer who's now retired from the law field, but he has a real interest in Salieri. He wrote a work, a historical novel called Damaging Winds. When I read that, I thought, you know, for years, since the time I first saw the movie, it's been percolating in the back burner somewhere of my mind. This, I got to do a play about the real Salieri.
Yeah.
Because he was so defamed and so slandered in the movie. Even though I loved the film, I think I was telling you outside before, just before we came on the air, I went to see Amadeus 15 times.
Yeah.
I kept wondering, now, what in this story is real and what is fiction? Well, the more research I did after reading a couple Salieri biographies and getting into his letters, I thought, man, how could Peter Schaffer get away with this? If there had been, I think, because, you know, it's never said, there's no disclaimer on Amadeus saying this is a work of fiction, my fantasy about
yeah.
what might have been. I think if there had been any Salieri survivors today, descendants, they would sue for defamation and would win, in my opinion.
Well, there's a whole troubling thing that happens with any artist of genius where you tend to undersell his or her contemporaries because, you know, usually a great artist is maybe just a little bit better than his contemporaries. But, you know, Muhammad Ali was defined in large part by Joe Frazier, right? There has to be somebody almost as good
right.
to get you to that level, don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. And Salieri, in fact, was the most famous composer of his day, which is to say the day of Mozart, the time of Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
Salieri was 6 years older than Mozart, but he was more popular, more respected, and more successful than Mozart during his day. Salieri wrote 42 operas, mm-hmm. many of them widely appreciated and revered. So to treat him as this second-rate, envious composer you know, that just struck me wrong. And I said, I have to do my little part and see if we can't correct this. And his music, Salieri's music, when you listen, I think anyone who listens to this program on Sunday afternoon, they're going to hear the overtures of Salieri and think, man, this guy was good. He was really. In fact, when I finished the script, my wife says to me, so now that you're done with this, how do you rate Salieri and Mozart? And I said, honey, Salieri is a great composer. Mozart was the greatest.
Well, but, you know, the thing that you did that very few people did after Amadeus was you listened to his works.
Right. Absolutely. I started collecting them, which was hard to do because there weren't very many.
But that's the whole thing that is so unfortunate about the way music is perceived, is that there's all these substitutes for listening to the music that people do, right? You accept convention, you know, you go with accepted knowledge, conventional wisdom that's really received from elsewhere. It isn't what your ears told you.
Right. Getting back to one quick point that I meant a moment ago, after the movie had come out, I at the time was doing a weekly program here on Hawaii Public Radio called More Mozart. And one of the shows I did a half-hour radio interview with Peter Schaffer over the phone. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, do you have any regrets at all that there wasn't some disclaimer somewhere, either beginning or end of this film, that says this is a fantasy, a work of fiction based on true life characters? And he says, you know, I really do, because I think a lot of people will look at this film and say that's the way it really was, when in fact he admitted he took tremendous dramatic license in making a lot of the things up.
You know, the sad thing in that whole story is that it used to be possible for people to understand what dramatic license was.
Right.
That maybe in an earlier time it wouldn't have been necessary to have that explanation, because people were used to what theater artists did, and that exaggeration is built into the whole thing, that you need conflict, all that stuff.
I have to tell you, too, when I contacted Murray once I finished this script and said, I've got a project I think you're going to like, but I'd like to send you the script and see what you think, because I'd like you to play the title character. And he says, all right, go ahead. He was a little, I could tell, he was a little standoffish, like, oh, no, another
Salieri
script.
Again.
And, yeah. And then he called me like the next day and said, I love this. He said, for years, 32 years, I've been waiting to do the story of Salieri. And he said he had turned down numerous scripts because they were like a rehash of Amadeus. I said, well, okay, let's do it.
Sounds great, Joe. Thanks a lot.
Sunday afternoon.
All right. Good to see you.
Thanks, Chris.
Joe Moore is the author of The Maligned Master, The Glorious Salieri, a 90-minute radio drama featuring the overtures of Antonio Salieri, performed by the Slovak Radio Symphony Orchestra. It'll have its world premiere on HPR1 this Sunday at 3 p.m., and F. Murray Abraham will perform as the ghost of Salieri, a reprise of his performance in the film Amadeus.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Whole Foods Market Hawaii, Ulupono Initiative, and Hawaii Pacific University.
Next time in Studio 360,
I believe we do things that really are magic and defy explanation.
We're going someplace magical.
I always thought Disneyland is like going to heaven.
When you wish upon a star.
The Disney theme parks. Next time in Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.
This afternoon at 4, right after Fresh Air.
You know, one of the things that Joe brought to this project about Salieri and Mozart was his understanding of how perceptions get created, because Joe is obviously a veteran communicator, and he sees how ideas take hold, sometimes take hold for all the wrong reasons, right?
And it's so easy when you have films or short pieces that are done on a particular person. There's a lot that's been left out, and there may be no disclaimer, as he said, that this is just a fantasy, an idea of something that might have happened, not real fact.
And yet, you know, the whole idea of it's only a movie, we seem to have lost that, as maybe they've taken over our minds to that.
Well, on the belief that, you know, the movie may in fact represent a book well or may represent history well. And
yeah.
I mean, we say things like docudrama, but we don't really know fully what that means.
That's right.
Anyway, we'll be listening with great interest
to
his radio play on Father's Day at 3 o'clock. Meanwhile, we have to say goodbye to you because it's almost 9 o'clock, but we'll be back next week with a couple of slices of the Coral Reef Symposium, including one researcher on the connection between conservation and religion.
And a young adult novel from a local author that looks at cross-cultural issues and the turmoil of adolescence. Your comments are always welcome about what you hear on the show or on our station. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217.
You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR if you want to get to me.
Past shows are archived on the Conversation page on the HPR website at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozovich. Lillian Song is our producer. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozovich. See you Monday for more of The Conversation.